Hello, listeners. It is March 9th, 2017. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. Things are heating up in Washington, and it's not just the weather. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. Anyway, the real heat is coming from Capitol Hill, where the most passionately litigated political issue of the decade is once again under the microscope. Congressional Republicans introduced their new health care bill this week. We'll talk about what's in it, how quickly it's moving, and why the GOP isn't united behind this solution to what's been its biggest policy priority for 7 years. We're also going to talk about President Donald Trump's tweets, which took aim at his predecessor in highly unusual fashion last weekend, and how they're affecting Congress's other big flashpoint right now, the intelligence investigation into Russia. And we'll take a step back at the end and try and think about what the early days of this presidency foreshadow for the later ones. I'm going to give you some data points for today's conversation, but first, remember, please email us if you have questions at nerdcast@politico.com. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and rate us and write a written review of Nerdcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast service. Okay, here are those data points I mentioned. 21 votes. That is the number of votes that Republicans can afford to lose from their own side in the House as they prepare to move their health care bill. Our next data point, 56%. That's the share of respondents in the latest Politico Morning Consult poll who said they'd like to see an independent counsel appointed to investigate any ties between Trump world and Russia. And our final data point, 50. Friday is the 50th day of Donald Trump's presidency, halfway through that fabled 100 days marker. And like I said, we're going to take a step back and try and take stock of what's happened and what we can glean from that going forward. All right, that's more than enough for me. Let's hear from the fellow nerdcasters, or maybe just my fellow nerds this week. Senior reporter Nancy Cook, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
National political reporter Eliana Johnson, welcome back.
Hey, Scott.
And senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian.
Hi, Scott.
Let's dive into data point number one. That's 21. That's the number of votes Republicans can afford to lose as they try to pass the health care bill they introduced this week through the House. So, Charlie, all right, they can lose 21, and it sounds like they may have started this week having to fight to add people on and get up to that number instead of just holding the caucus together from the start and being able to work down. Tell us a little bit about what's happened.
Well, I think it's just a reminder that even in Republican-controlled Washington, even in an era where Republicans control the House, Senate, and most of the governorships and the presidency, it's still a very precarious situation when it comes to passing big pieces of legislation. And the kind of numbers we're talking about here suggest just how difficult, what the degree of difficulty is going to be in passing this repeal and replace measure. There's not a lot of room for error. You've only got 21 votes that you can spare in the House, and there are lots of factors that might drive Republicans to vote against this. You've got the Freedom Caucus, and we don't know exactly how many members there are in there, but we know it's somewhere around 30. They all have various concerns. You've got moderate Republicans who've got concerns. You've got Republicans sitting in districts that Hillary Clinton won in November. So there's lots of cause for these folks to depart from the party line.
The other dynamic I would point out is most Freedom Caucus members are in districts Donald Trump won in November. And so
handily,
I think the real dynamic here is how hard does Donald Trump come out and campaign for this bill? Because he is tremendously popular in these districts where the Freedom Caucus members come from. And if they are perceived as bucking the president on this, I think they may start to feel that there will be a real political cost for them in 2018. And they have to weigh that against the possibility that this bill will do real harm to people's health care. That's what conservative wonks are warning again, that it could exacerbate some of these death spirals that we're seeing with Obamacare right now, and that will cost them at the ballot box, just as Obamacare did in 2010 and 2014. There is going to be some really interesting political calculations going on within that Freedom Caucus and even the sort of RSC groups on the Hill, a group that's conservative but to the left of the Freedom Caucus.
It's a really important point to keep in mind. This is the first time that anyone has ever had leverage on the Freedom Caucus. These are, as Eliana mentioned, these are all the 29 publicly admitted members of the Freedom Caucus, Trump carried all their districts. And I suspect once you get the people who are sort of on the outer ring of that caucus as well, you'd find the same is true. And it's not just that Trump carried their districts. In most cases, he was in the 60s and in some cases even in the 70s in terms of the percentage he won. And so forget all this business about Trump's being underwater in disapproval ratings. In these places, Donald Trump is very popular, and these members are going to be very reticent to buck him given how they know their constituents feel about the president.
Nancy, take us through the policy here. What is in this Republican health care bill that is causing some of this opposition from the right? And there's opposition from kind of the left flank of the Republican Party, too, and we can talk about that later. But what is bothering conservatives in this bill?
Well, it really comes down to a lot of the tax questions, because the way that this bill is being put together is it's basically through this reconciliation process. And so it can really only deal with the federal spending and revenue side of it. And so the part that's making these conservatives so mad is that there are still some taxes in there. They've gotten rid of some of the taxes to pay for that paid for the Affordable Care Act, but there are still some taxes that are not gone immediately, like the so-called Cadillac tax, which is a key way to pay for it. That's sort of put off because it raises quite a lot of money, and if they got rid of it immediately, it would look like it really added to the deficit. But then the other thing, sort of the main point, is that it keeps these tax credits in place, but just changes sort of who benefits from them. And conservatives don't want those tax credits there at all. And so this bill would still keep them in place. It would just sort of the poor people would lose out and the wealthy people would get more. But just the tax credits broadly are infuriating all these conservative groups and very conservative people.
What about from the other side? We just talked about approximately 29, at least as far as we know, House Freedom Caucus members who are really pushing and coming at this bill from the right. What about, say, the 24 House Republicans who are from districts that Hillary Clinton carried over Donald Trump in November? What's in here that might be causing them a little bit of heartburn?
Well, I think what's causing them heartburn, and also what's causing some heartburn in the Senate, particularly with senators like Cory Gardner of Colorado, Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, they don't want – so this bill would eventually phase out the expansion of Medicaid. And in states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, which Trump won – the expansion of Medicaid has hugely benefited a ton of people on the ground and given people health insurance for the first time. And so particularly in the Senate, these four senators said, you know, we don't want anything that gets rid of that. And this bill would eventually phase it out. And the thing is, we don't have the score yet from the Congressional Budget Office, which is like the nonpartisan kind of budget scorekeeper. But once we have that, we'll have a very clear view of how many people will lose coverage under this plan. That will be a big moment for the Republicans, and also what this does to the deficit. Does it add to it? Does it take away from it? I think the hunch is that it'll probably add to the deficit, and that some conservative scholars have estimated that, you know, as many as 10 to 15 million people will lose coverage under this. But again, we don't have the official scorecard.
I think what has put Republican leadership in a really precarious position here is that in the House, they have to walk a very fine line between keeping members of the Freedom Caucus and the Republican Study Committee on board by giving the impression of attempting to do a full repeal or repealing as much of the law as possible. In the Senate, there are several Republican states that expanded Medicaid, and that fear being cast as leaving a lot of the poorest people in their states in the lurch when that aspect of the bill is rolled back. And you saw Tom Cotton of Arkansas, one of the most conservative members of the Senate, say that he fears this is this process is moving too fast. Interesting to note that it was the Democratic governor of Arkansas who expanded Medicaid in that state. And so he's put in a precarious position. And so there are Republicans who don't want to see that Medicaid expansion rolled back. Republican leaders are acutely conscious of that. And the conservative members of the House Freedom Caucus and beyond who want to see really a full repeal of this law. What does legislation look like that keeps all of those people inside the tent and only loses, you know, 21 House members and two members of the Senate? I don't know, but that is a really, really hard line for Republican leaders to walk.
And just broadly, I mean, it just plays into the whole problem that Republicans have faced on policy for a long time is that, you know, you want to do things, they want to do things that are fiscally conservative, that don't add to the deficit, but they also don't want to look like they're just the party of the rich. And that's what they potentially could do with this bill, with the, if they get rid of the expansion of Medicaid, and also the tax credits totally favor rich people, not poor. And that, you know, you don't want to look like a heartless party.
And at the top of the pyramid, you have a leader who no one really knows where he stands on many of these key issues. I think we're going to learn a ton about Donald Trump and how he thinks at the end of this process. I mean, I think we've always known that he's more transactional in nature than ideological. And from all the statements that, you know, I've heard him say, and from what we hear, the conflicting reports of what White House aides are telling folks on the Hill and telling the interest groups suggests that there's not a real hard edge there at the White House, that ultimately they'll be comfortable with almost anything. And so I think at the end of the day, we're going to learn as much about the Trump administration and how it thinks from this process as the entire campaign and the first 50 days of the Trump administration.
Sorry, Nancy, go ahead.
Well, and our colleagues, Josh Dossi and Rachel Bade, had a good piece last night after Trump had a private meeting at the White House with some of the leaders of very conservative groups like the Club for Growth and Heritage Foundation. And basically the takeaway from that meeting was that, you know, Trump hopes that the health care law passes. If it doesn't, you know, he's going to basically let Obamacare just fail and try to blame it on the Democrats.
These groups that he was meeting with at the White House, these are some of the traditionally the most powerful conservative groups, the Club for Growth, Americans for Prosperity, a lot of other groups that have big pull in Republican primaries, big pull in Republican policy fights, and they are all coming at this from the right. And then if you shift it too far over to where they are, you maybe start to lose. It's called the Tuesday group, these moderate House Republicans, some from battleground districts, some from less so, but you could easily see how when you move the window a little too far to one side or the other, just people start dropping off, and it's impossible to cram them all into a window. That said, House Speaker Paul Ryan says it's going to pass. He's got those 21 votes to spare. Mitch McConnell says it's going to pass the Senate. So what gives?
What I find most interesting here is that we're beginning to understand what it's like to be a president who gets elected without the support of any real constituency groups, meaning it doesn't really matter to him that Heritage or the AMA or the AHA or any of these groups oppose this measure. He doesn't owe anyone, and that's a really unique position to be in for a president. He doesn't owe anyone, so he can come out wherever he wants. He has a lot more leeway to operate on this than I think a traditional president might have.
Yeah, and I think that the White House, you know, you sort of get the sense that the White House doesn't really care that much about how this healthcare fight turns out. It's more just that they want it to work out because they don't want it to slow down other things that they want to do. But it's not like they have this, you know, that there's this cohesive sense among White House aides and even the president that this is how healthcare should be. It's more like we just don't want to get bogged down in this and not be able to do tax reform.
And I'm not sure, you know, I think that's true. This is not a particularly policy-driven White House. I'm not sure how much that actually matters now that there's a bill on the table, because I think that the White House is acutely conscious of the fact that if this bill fails, this White House is likely to fail.
Right.
If Donald Trump is not successful in pulling back Obamacare regulations, and therefore if Republican leaders in Congress are not successful right now, it will be an enormous blow to his presidency coming right out of the gate.
So you think it's really that devastating if they were unable to accomplish it? That devastating to the Trump presidency?
I do think so.
Yeah, I agree with that, because it's just – it will look like such a blow, their first early blow, that they weren't able to work with Congress and they weren't able to pass this through.
I'm not convinced of that. Let me make the contrarian argument here. I think, again, he is such a unique creature that I don't know that he would suffer all that much, because he will just turn it on the Democrats or he will turn it on Washington and say he did his best. And I think what he will do is probably publicize the extent to which he tried to make deals and bring these warring parties together. He'll triangulate against them. I think there are other things that may even be even more important to him, like infrastructure. If he were able to do that, he could drive a wedge in the Democratic coalition. He could speak to a lot of the various groups that voted him in. To me, it would be a serious blow But I'm not sure I'm yet convinced that it is a devastating blow.
Nancy, you mentioned the Congressional Budget Office score earlier. That's going to say how much the bill is going to cost. They're going to give an estimate of what coverage is going to look like on the health insurance markets after this. What else should we look for in the legislative process as big milestones over the next few weeks?
Well, the House, two House committees have marked up the bill. The House Ways and Means Committee has already done it. And then the House Energy and Commerce Committee, I think, is still marking up the bill now. And so what the outcomes of both of those are and what the text kind of looks like and how the Democrats protest, that will be sort of an interesting thing for policy wonks to watch. And then I just think, what are the plans moving forward? You know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said before earlier this week that he was going to ram through the House bill with very little discussion. Does he stick to that, which will probably anger some other senators quite a bit, or does he give some wiggle room on that?
All right, let's move on to our second data point. That's 56. That's the percentage of respondents in the latest Politico Morning Consult poll who said they would like to see an independent counsel appointed to investigate alleged ties between members of President Trump's campaign and the Russian government, or Russian government affiliates. We've got a few new Nerdcasters here to talk with us. We've got White House correspondent Eli Stokels.
Hello.
And chief investigative reporter Ken Vogel.
That's me. Hi.
So, Ken, start us off here. After we talked about Attorney General Jeff Sessions last week and meeting with the Russian ambassador, he recused himself from future investigations of Trump-Russia connections. And since then, you've written a few more stories fleshing out some of those connections between people in Trump world. Not Trump himself, not always inner circle advisors, but people connected to Trump and their connections with Russia. What have you found out this week?
Well, for instance, we found out that Carter Page, who was a foreign policy advisor, who was a little bit of a peripheral player on the Trump campaign, but nonetheless he became controversial because he made a trip to Moscow in July where he spoke at a school and gave a speech that was pretty condemnatory of U.S. foreign policy towards Russia and laudatory of Russia, became controversial. The Trump campaign distanced themselves from him, said we had nothing to do with the guy, we had nothing to do with his trip. He's a foreign policy advisor in name only and isn't a critical player. Well, turns out we found out that, in fact, Corey Lewandowski, the former campaign manager, at the time when Carter Page had submitted a request to get this trip approved by the campaign, signed off on this trip, said, yes, you can go. Don't, however, represent yourself as a member of the campaign, just as an individual going to Russia. Nonetheless, the school ended up billing him as a campaign advisor. So you see sort of yet another example where the Trump team has come out with a blanket denial that has turned out in retrospect to be false and is revealed to have been false, or at least misleading by media reports. So, yes, you mentioned Sessions. Sessions, what did he do? He told the Judiciary Committee that he didn't talk with the Russians. Turns out he did. Mike Flynn told the media, told actually Vice President Mike Pence that though he did talk to the Russian ambassador, he didn't talk about the U.S. sanctions on Russia. Turns out he did. You had the Trump team saying that they didn't have anything to do with the move to dilute a proposed amendment to the GOP platform that would be more aggressive towards Russia and more supportive of Ukraine. Turns out, in fact, they had something to do with that. So you have time and again a situation where they're having trouble getting their story straight. And it's almost like the cover up in some of these cases is worse than the crime. That's a bad recipe for trying to change the narrative and move beyond these stories.
Eli, you've written and talked a little bit about your particular take on why this drip matters. There's a couple things here. There's a distraction from the policy agenda, but this stuff also just enrages Trump. And we saw that a little bit this weekend, right?
We did. We saw him sort of lose it on Friday in the Oval Office after an event, right after the Sessions recusal. And he brought in his closest advisors and just lit them up, screamed at them as if it's their fault, right? As if Jeff Sessions, I mean, I think Trump clearly did not want Sessions to recuse himself. He's sort of the mind that, you know, I don't care what the precedent is. I don't care what the lawyers advise. I don't care what's on the conservative or safe side. This shows weakness. I don't like it. Why didn't he talk to us? And he was very angry with Reince and with everyone basically for letting this get to a point where Sessions is recusing himself. And on its face, it just looks like another sort of PR nightmare on the Russia story. And as Ken just laid out, there are several of those. So it's upsetting to Trump because they feel like this Russia thing just won't go away. They don't understand why. Saturday down at Mar-a-Lago, our reports are that the president was still angry about this. He wakes up, obviously, doesn't tell anybody, just goes on this crazy tweet storm and blames President Obama for wiretapping him without any evidence. So we know that it gets Trump off track, right? You go back a couple days before all this and what had happened. Trump had, quote, became the president because he gave that joint address to Congress and everybody thought it went so well. He faded back. He receded. He said, let's let this ride. We like this news cycle. We need this. And then all forgotten about. So it distracts him. And it also has the potential, as I think Eliana and Ken can talk about it, to sidetrack the policy agenda. They have a lot on their plate right now as it pertains to what's happening on the Hill, and the drip, drip, drip of daily news is about Russia.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. Is this distracting Trump, or is it kind of distracting the White House and Republicans in Washington more broadly?
Well, both. But certainly the reason I think it's so notable why it's distracting Trump, why it's so frustrating to Trump, as Eli just laid out, is that these tactics that he would use during the campaign to great effect to kind of change the subject and pivot away from a bad narrative, that is throwing out an explosive allegation or just completely trying to change the subject, are not working. In fact, the tweet storm that Eli mentioned, where he accused former President Obama, without any evidence of wiretapping his phones, that's only like created an additional parallel line of inquiry that is sort of exacerbating this Russia story. So the tactics from the campaign are not carrying over to the White House.
The thing that's really shocked me in all of this is for all the political talents that President Trump has, they seem to have really politically fumbled this whole Russia thing and really had a tin ear with regard to the political explosiveness that it's had, in the sense that they haven't treated it as something potentially politically explosive and regarded every potential interaction with the Russian government with tremendous sensitivity. And that goes from Corey Lewandowski signing off on a trip during the campaign in the summer, all the way to Jeff Sessions' testimony, when he seemed not to approach any question about Russia as something that could ignite a political firestorm, and respond with, let me check my notes on that. There seemed to be no awareness that he needed to be extremely careful, because any question about Russia, no matter what it is, could really become a scandal.
And undergirding what Eliana just said is this distinction between like the style and the way that they've approached it and the substance of these allegations. And like, I've been digging pretty hard on this stuff, and I've talked to a lot of these people who the FBI, congressional investigators, the CIA should be talking to if they were actually trying to turn up anything, on Trump's connections to Russia, or the campaign's interactions with Russia vis-a-vis some of the meddling that the Russians did. And I have not found, much to my chagrin, because my professional chagrin, because I spent a lot of time doing this, I have not found any kind of smoking gun, or even any suggestion that there is the possibility of finding such a smoking gun. And further, I have not even found, a lot of these people just flatly deny. They say that the FBI has not talked to them, that congressional investigators haven't talked to them, a lot of the like key players in this. And to me, it suggests, look, they could be lying to me. That's certainly a possibility. Or the FBI is really holding its cards close to its vest, and maybe that they have something that's explosive. Or they're slow walking this, or they're not even doing this type of inquiry. So, I think that with a more tactful, adept approach to some of these questions, the Trump campaign could, or the Trump White House could, if not suffocate the story, at least stay away from these like one-off controversies, which are really what continues to drive
and then exacerbate. Yeah, the,
I agree.
Original.
It's not necessarily the substance that is really like catching them up here. It's the way that they've approached it.
Yeah, the hyper-political response to this, the nervousness, the anger at the press for talking about this, the just complete dismissiveness is a tell. It's a tell that looks like someone who doesn't want an investigation to go forward, which makes you wonder, why not?
It also happens to be the way that Trump reacts to everything.
It does. But I mean, this is a guy who has been willfully blind to every behavior, everything that Vladimir Putin has done, Donald Trump has sort of gone out and made excuses for him. The intelligence community has come out and said, we know that Vladimir Putin interfered in the election on Donald Trump's behalf. OK, so the reason why the country has questions are obvious and understandable, and it's beyond politics. It's about preserving a democracy. So they've just been very short-sighted in terms of trying to completely sweep this under the rug, dismiss it, get it to go away, and they look downright Nixonian.
And so speaking of the House Intelligence Committee, so we've got the first public hearing that they're holding on Russia and the election coming up on March 20th. They've invited FBI Director James Comey, NSA head Mike Rogers, former CIA Director John Brennan, former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. There could be a lot of very big names in the intelligence world testifying at this first public hearing, and it's going to, you know, it shows how this is a story that continues to roll forward in a more and more public way now with Congress jumping in to investigate some of this stuff and starting those public hearings. Ken?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of skeptical of the degree to which these hearings will shed any kind of significant light on what we know or don't know about these very substantive issues. I think there's kind of a bifurcated process. You do have the FBI, whatever they're doing, they say that they're doing an investigation. You got to take them at their word, even though, as I said, I haven't seen like a ton of evidence of it. And then you have the congressional committees that are availing themselves of what the CIA, the intelligence that the CIA has to offer. Our colleagues were the first to report that they that key members of these committees were going to Langley, to the CIA, to read these intelligence reports. But I think that some of the stuff that will come out of it is nonetheless significant. That will be to sort of put some meat on the bones of what we saw from the intelligence community in this public report, this very rare and sort of exceptional public report earlier about Russia's meddling in the election. Like, that's significant. I don't mean to minimize that. That is serious, and it's a public service for them to be able to shed light on it. I'll be interested in what they have to say. I don't think we'll see a ton of evidence speaking to this bigger so what question, which is, did they have cooperation, communication, really any kind of relationship at all with the Trump campaign vis-a-vis this meddling during the campaign?
And ironically, it's Donald Trump's unwillingness to give a full-throated condemnation in the original sin, which is the Russians meddling in the campaign, because he perceives it as undermining the legitimacy of his victory. I think that's led to consistent ballooning of this scandal and the actual, you know, undermining of his presidency now that it's continuing.
That's a great point, Elian. And, you know, in the midst of all this, we're seeing WikiLeaks this week dumping which is tied up in all of this with the role of leaking emails, hacked emails from the DNC, hacked emails from John Podesta, posting what appear to be some extremely sensitive CIA documents online this week, showing the agency allegedly had all these tools to compromise home electronics and all sorts of other things. It's all kind of continues to build.
Well, the intelligence community has come out and said that they look at WikiLeaks as a repository for Russian spies, for Russian information that they want to put out, that they have leaked it straight to WikiLeaks. So, you know, Trump was out there, remember, back to the campaign, and Trump would stand up there and he'd say, WikiLeaks, I love the WikiLeaks.
WikiLeaks, I love WikiLeaks.
You know, he was before the leaks, before now he's against leaking. But think about that, all right? This could have been a guy sitting there benefiting from information coming from the Russian government through WikiLeaks straight to Donald Trump's presidential campaign.
Ken, last word.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot, there are some folks who are like trying to characterize this as, look, see, WikiLeaks is not in bed with Trump. They're releasing this information that embarrasses his CIA, and I think that's the wrong way to look at it. If anything, Trump has had an adversarial relationship with the CIA and the intelligence community, and they're not releasing information that's damaging about Trump. They're releasing information that, in this case, is damaging towards the CIA. So in some ways, you know, I've already gotten a few emails from sort of more conspiratorially minded readers who are suggesting that this is part of an effort by the Russians through WikiLeaks to undermine the CIA because the CIA is potentially coming after or jeopardizing Trump's presidency.
Wheels within wheels. Let's take a quick break for a programming note. All this month, Politico is teaming up with podcasts all over the country to raise podcast awareness for an initiative called #Tripod. That's tripod with a Y. We at the Nerdcast love data, so here's another number for you. One in five Americans listens to a podcast. Now, Charlie, you are one of those Americans. What are some of your favorite shows?
Well, as a podcast American, I listen to a bunch of different podcasts. Some of my favorites are I love NPR's Code Switch. It's pretty great. There's another one called Migration Nation, which I like a lot, which is about the history of American migration and how it formed the country. But I think my favorite is, as you know, because I talk about it a lot before the show, is The Guardian's Football Weekly, which I love. I'm a big fan of the English Premier League, and I love it. I listen to it a lot with my daughter or, you know, when I'm driving into work. And it's fantastic, even though I think a lot of it goes over my head because I don't even understand all these English expressions. You know, you'd think we share a common language, but I learn a lot about the mechanics of podcasts and successful podcasts by just by listening to the way they interact and the kinds of ways they approach the different issues on that podcast.
That's such a good point. That's one of the reasons I love Radiolab so much. Also, it definitely feeds the repressed science geek within this journalist. So, listeners, we need your help. We want you to find one of those Americans, one of those 4 out of 5 Americans who doesn't listen to podcasts, a friend, a relative, that cool coworker in the office, like Charlie. Find that person and explain to them what a podcast is, where to find one, and how to listen.
And when you complete that mission, tell us what you recommended with #tripod. That's #TRYPOD.
All right, now back to the show. All right, let's introduce our third and final data point of this week as we welcome Nancy and Charlie back into the studio. That data point is 50, and that is how many days into the Trump administration we will be on Friday, as many of you are listening to this. It is the halfway point of the traditional first 100 days that we've come to judge as the launch pad of presidencies. Nancy, let's start with you. How is the Trump administration doing so far? Better or worse than the Trump team expected? Better or worse than their fellow Republicans in Congress and outside of government expected? Better or worse than kind of the historical what we judge them against?
I would say it's been a mixed bag. I would give them a C minus if we're going to grade.
That's not a mixed bag. That's not very good.
It's still passing, though. I feel like they are, you know, so Trump has done some, let's talk about the good things or things that would be viewed as accomplishments from the Republican side. You know, he's done, I think, a good job with, you know, doing a lot of executive actions. The New York Times had a good story earlier this week about how he has actually signed 90, some of which you know about, some of which you don't. Things that were giveaways to the NRA, for instance, the financial services industry. I think he's done really well with the optics of making it appear like he's meeting with business leaders, working on creating jobs. You know, that does matter. Things he's fallen short on, definitely personnel in terms of filling the White House, filling the agencies with the people you need to run the government, even getting all of the cabinets confirmed. He's much farther behind even Obama, President Bush were at this point. And then just in terms of the policy, you know, starting off with healthcare, which I know we have already talked about, but just to touch on briefly, you know, this has been Republicans, a lot of Republicans wanted it repealed right away. Now we're kind of stuck in this fight. Not everyone's happy. And that could really slow things down.
I'm not really convinced that a 100-day metric is really even relevant for Donald Trump. I mean, he's a non-traditional president, so I don't see that we can really apply a traditional yardstick to what he accomplished. There's, you know, an interesting discussion among political scientists referring to, you know, Trump as something of representing a disjunctive presidency, sort of in the same way that, you know, maybe Jimmy Carter's might have, straddling the eras. And so I think between that, between his non-traditional demeanor and approach, I think we have to apply an almost totally different yardstick when assessing Donald Trump. And it also depends on what you're trying to assess. Are you trying to assess his ability to get reelected in 2020, or are you just trying to assess his accomplishments? Because to me, if we're talking about 2020 and is he getting closer to get it to reelection and positioning himself for reelection, the things to measure would be less about concrete legislative accomplishments, because I don't think that that's what he really campaigned on. I think he campaigned as a lightning rod, and I think the way that you measure him, or at least his constituents will measure him, the people that voted him will be, does it look like he's dismantling the regulatory state? Is he taking on political correctness? Is he sticking it to the media and the establishment? What is he doing on jobs? Is he still counting them? Because I think that's a brilliant political ploy, even if in the bigger picture it's sort of meaningless. And I think the way to look at whether he's having success in moving forward to re-election and getting closer to having a viable path to re-election is he channeling and expressing the rage of the white working class?
You know, those are all good points, and I certainly take them.
I'm about to get killed, aren't I?
No. I could
feel it coming. Okay, drop the
ball. No, I mean, he's in many ways he is doing what his supporters wanted. The issue is when he actually tries to take on some of the promises that he did make that were more substantive in tone, such as the wall. What's going on with the wall? Well, nothing. You know, the immigration ban, immigration restrictions, the executive order. Nancy mentioned that the executive orders he signed, a lot of them, sure. But the highest profile one, restricting travel from the Muslim countries, is like a little bit of a disaster and is very much in limbo. So I think that people will look at those and be able to assess whether he actually took on and accomplished these specific things that he promised. And so far, I mean, again, 50 days in, but so far the answer is no.
Nancy, what's the – if you had to pick one thing that you've seen in these first 50 days that you think illuminates what – the next 50 days and the next 100 days after that and this administration looks like going forward, what would it be?
Well, this sounds kind of wonky, but it's important. I mean, I just feel like the White House's inability to fill jobs is really going to slow them down, because they're having this huge tussle with cabinet secretaries. You know, they want to put their own people in all the agencies. You know, the White House is not totally staffed up. The agencies, like the majority of agencies, don't have deputy secretaries. They don't have chiefs of staff. And like at some point, the federal government has 2.1 million workers. Like, you need people in all these agencies to get the regulations going if you're going to get, you know, rid of two regulations for every one. You know, you need people at the agencies if you're going to get rid of Obamacare. And so I think the staffing thing is going to be a huge thing. Like, you know, Trump is kind of running the West Wing at this point like a family business. You know, he wants to have this small team. He wants to have people he can kind of trust and play off each other. And it's really hard to have the federal government work like that. Like, that's not really how it works. It's this big bureaucracy that you need to kind of embrace and try to figure out how to lead and control in some way. And he seems really resistant to that. And so I think that'll be something very key that I'll be watching for the next 50 days.
Yeah, and something that I'll be watching that's sort of a corollary of what Nancy just said is the infighting. And I think that the infighting in the White House in particular, but also, you know, across the sort of high level cabinet secretary and undersecretary and staffing positions is something that is, it's not, as they say, a quirk. It is like a feature of Trump's management style. We saw it on the campaign. We saw it with his businesses. We saw it on The Apprentice. What he likes to do is surround himself with these sort of factions of folks who are going to compete with one another. And there's some sort of management philosophy that suggests that this is a good way to get the cream to rise to the top, to have this type of competition. But it really
matters. Management philosophy is that?
I mean, you know, you see some businesses, whether intentionally or not, that are set up in this way, where there's sort of competing fiefdoms that produce competing ideas. The idea being that, like, the best ideas will rise to the top, and whoever is most convincing at selling them is going to win. But in Trump's case, it also produces these really, like, sort of toxic environments, and that, like, what we saw on the campaign, that's now playing out in the White House. Our colleague Alex Eisenstadt, Josh Dawsey, had a great story about Reince Priebus. The knives are out for Reince Priebus. Well, the knives are out for a lot of people, and I don't see that changing. I see that's something that's going to continue to hinder the Trump administration.
Well, also something else I'll be watching in the next 50 days off of what Ken said is, you know, does anyone get fired? Like, does Reince Priebus get fired? And if he gets fired, will take a bunch of people from the West Wing with him. You know, does the heads roll anywhere else? Are there anyone else that drops out or, you know, drops out of the cabinet process that's frustrated by sort of the lack of process there? So I think that will be a very interesting thing to watch as well.
Charlie, what about you? What's the kind of one thing that you've seen that you think we need to be paying attention to forecast going forward?
I think are they on a trajectory toward normalcy? And that may sound a little bit odd. And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, lots of new administrations struggle in their first year to varying degree. I mean, the first Clinton administration, you know, was a real struggle in the first year. But I don't see any movement toward a sense of equilibrium in the administration so far. I don't see them on a trajectory toward normalcy, in part because for all the reasons that Ken talked about, but I also I'm not sure that that's a coherent philosophy that they're pursuing. I think it is just total seat of the pants governance, and that's just not sustainable in an operation like the federal government and in an office like the White House. And so I'll be looking to see, are they able to address some of these personnel issues? Are they able to get more talent into top offices? Because right now, I have to say, there's lots of folks in the top echelon jobs that, you know, have you scratching your heads. And, you know, every administration has a couple people like that. But let's be honest, there's a bunch of folks who raise serious questions, or at least in the communities they come from, they are not well respected, or they worry a lot of the folks that are familiar with their work. So, I mean, I think just getting on an even keel and moving toward some semblance of normalcy in the everyday blocking and tackling the fundamentals of governments, that's what I'll be watching to see if they can move in that direction.
Well, and so much of the staffing issues have come down to, you know, the fact that the White House doesn't want to hire anyone who ever said anything negative about Donald Trump. And so, for instance, that's really tripping things up at the Treasury Department, where the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, you know, has held Democratic fundraisers before. And, you know, a lot of New Yorkers and people in finance that he wants to, you know, bring down into the Treasury Department, they're not necessarily people who were for Trump. And, you know, the White House is nixing all of those people. And so will they also move past this idea that, like, if you weren't with us in the campaign, you will never be with us? Because that kind of grudge holding, you know, may not work for the next 4 years.
And also, it's really hard to find, you know, very qualified people in these specific issue areas who were gung-ho about Donald Trump during the campaign. And you already see some folks, you know, getting tapped for some fairly senior positions who are being accused of having been less than enthusiastic about Donald Trump. And, you know, that those folks got in the front door, but it doesn't mean that they're going to be you know, effective cogs in a cohesive machine. It means, in fact, that the knives are going to be out for them on not just the sort of policy issues and the differences and debates going forward, but even looking backward to the campaign. That's not a formula for a big, happy family.
I think one thing that I saw this week that I want to keep an eye on going forward is that Suffolk and USA Today conducted a poll. They asked voters, do you think the country's on the right track? Do you think the country's on the wrong track? And 46% said right track, 43% said wrong track. I'm going to quote from the USA Today story now. In about 1,000 national polls tracked by RealClearPolitics.com since 2009, just one other survey released last month has shown a net positive rating on the right direction, wrong track question. That's incredible. And I think it speaks to, even though Trump himself is personally unpopular still on average, I think that speaks to some optimism that some people are feeling about his presidency. And I think it's going to be important to see going forward what happens to that number. And is that number high right now because Republicans who are kind of feeling psychically good about Republicans being in control of government in Washington, at some point are they going to need some of these policy fights that we've been talking about? Obamacare repeal, to cite one, to actually come through for them, and or will they start fading out of that right track number? I think that's going to be really important to watch going forward.
I think what's often overlooked about Donald Trump, certainly it's overlooked by journalists like us, and it's overlooked, I think, in the big cities of the nation, is that Donald Trump has a decent amount of support outside of Washington. And now if you were to break down all the polling, it shows 8 out of 10 Democrats hate him. But at the same time, 8 out of 10 Republicans like him and or approve of the job he's doing. And just as interesting, independents are split. You know, once those numbers change, if he has some erosion in those numbers, obviously his situation is going to become much more difficult. But right now, he is not nearly as unpopular as lots of journalists assume. And I think that is something to
it's
watch.
It's fairly narrow. It's like 45-50 in the pollster.com averages.
Yeah, and the key is, I'm not saying he's popular, but what I am saying is he's still in the realm of a viable national candidate who can win re-election. That America is divided on him right now. It doesn't hate him, which was, I think, the narrative coming out of the first couple weeks of the presidency, that this was a guy who had very little popular support at all. And it turns out that's not the case.
Well, I mean, there were some polls that showed that his unfavorables coming into office were significantly higher than that of any sort of recent president. That said, they maybe not significant. I shouldn't say that. We're higher.
Well, his numbers historically are terrible compared to newly elected presidents. He never got a honeymoon period, and that's what the polls show.
Right, and that's an important thing. But I agree with you as well that we should be cautious in our rush to decree this disastrous first 50 days or something like that, because there are clearly people who are measuring him on a different scale, like they did throughout the campaign. And we in the media and we in the sort of political class more broadly did miss that. And so here we have our first test since he took office of whether we're going to repeat that mistake or whether we are going to realize, as you said, that he's a different kind of politician being judged differently by his supporters and perhaps by the American electorate writ large.
That's a great point, Ken. I think that's a great place to wrap up for this week. Thank you, everyone, for an illuminating discussion. Nancy, thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Charlie, thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
And Ken, thank you as always.
Hey, fun time, as always.
And, of course, thank you very much to our listeners. Remember, please send in your questions to nerdcast@politico.com and subscribe and rate us if you haven't already. Also, a big thank you, as always, to our executive producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, and Nerdcast researcher and Politico producer, Zach Montalaro. Take care, listeners. We'll talk to you again next week.